Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Rebecca Sibilia, the executive director of a brand new organization called EdFund, joins us to debate to what degree we fixed school funding in America. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber reports on a new study examining the effects of school shootings on survivors' test scores, attendance, and long-term health. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I'm just glad that I know the name is pronounced Killian now instead of Cillian. I feel like that much smarter.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guest for this week, Rebecca Sibilia. Rebecca, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, Mike. The last time I was here, you called me the Lady Gaga of education. So I'm not sure if that still stands.
Wow, absolutely. I love that. Although maybe we need to update it a little bit. Lady Gaga, I don't know. I don't see her as much anymore. Maybe we need to give you the Ariana Grande.
Oh, man. Ariana Grande is definitely much better than Lady Gaga. I will take it.
That dress at the Oscars, wow, that was something.
It was something. I've got to lose you to love me, Mike. I've got to lose you to love me.
Well, I'm very excited to announce that Rebecca is the executive director of a brand new organization launching as we speak. It is called EdFund, and she's here to talk about it and have a little debate with us about school finance. First, though, let's welcome my co-host, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Great to see you, David. David's always up for a good debate around school finance and so much else.
Go easy on me, Dave.
Well, you two might be teaming up on me today. But let's get into it. There's always been a debate about education finance, but with this new organization, you're getting right into it. Let's talk about it on Ed Reform Update. All right. So, Rebecca, first of all, tell us just a few words here about this new organization. Some of our listeners may know you from your old organization that closed its doors a few years ago called EdBuild. Now you are back with EdFund. What's it all about?
So EdFund is really kind of focused on making sure that we're shifting the research agenda in school finance away from this like esoteric question of does money matter to actually usable information for policymakers and advocates who tend to often be in the dark about where to put that marginal dollar, right? Because it's one thing to say unlimited resources will always raise student achievement. But when you're living in a constrained resource environment like states are, you actually need much more practical information about what is working and what isn't in terms of how we're distributing dollars. So we're looking to, one, fund more research that's driven by questions that policymakers have rather than questions that get published in journals. And two, making sure that we're translating that research in a way that advocates and policymakers can use it to make day-to-day decisions. This has really been kind of a big gap in the field, and we're excited to be filling it.
All right. That's fantastic. Well, and good timing, of course. The ESSER money is running out. Schools are largely under-enrolled. This is causing people to ask questions again about school spending and, as you say, what to do with that marginal dollar or which marginal dollar to cut, if that is the case. All right. Well, Rebecca, we have enjoyed debating one another over the years on many things related to school finance. We put out a study, a Think Again paper by our colleague Adam Tyner last year that said, hey, there's this conventional wisdom that you still read about our, quote, unfunded or underfunded public schools, about how there's still these big equity gaps. And he wrote, hey, not everything's not perfect, but you know what? We've made a ton of progress. In fact, for the last couple of decades, we've been pretty close to equity, depending on how you measure it. Most state funding formulas are quite progressive. Again, maybe not perfect and maybe not everywhere, but this is certainly we are no longer living in the age of savage inequalities that Jonathan Kozol wrote about long ago. And yet sometimes the discussion still sounds like it's like that. I think if our perspective is that the glass is half full, maybe yours is that the glass is half empty. But you tell us, how much further do we have to go towards fixing our state funding formulas?
So first of all, I'm Italian and from New Jersey, so the glass is always half empty. But I do want to make a paradoxical statement, or a statement that may sound paradoxical. It can be true that on average, low-income students are receiving about the same amount of money as their higher wealth peers. And it can also be true that we have not fixed funding formula policy. And so this is where I kind of got all my Muppet arms raised in response to your brief, which is true in terms of what the research is telling us, that there is an outcome that low-income kids are getting as much money as their higher wealth peers, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's because the policy is good. And I want to make sure that we're not conflating that, because we can't let policymakers off the hook on how bad some of their policies are, which means we need to talk about how we may get to a place where we have this evening of money.
All right. So give us one example here, because I'm a little confused. So you're saying don't give them credit. Okay. I thought you were going to say, well, it's still not enough money for poor kids. And I think we actually would agree there, right? We know, for example, if you want to get great teachers to our highest poverty schools, you're going to have to pay them significantly more, right? And so you don't just need to equalize funding, you need a, you know, pretty significantly progressive funding formula to make something like that happen. Okay. But you're saying something different. You're saying that these funding formulas are screwed up, and yet despite themselves, they are getting the money to the poor schools. Explain.
So I want to address that one point of funding formulas needing to be more progressive in a place where we're competing for a highly qualified and highly effective workforce. What you would hope then is that we don't have a bunch of school district borders where neighbors have significantly different amounts of money. But throughout the country, we have over 950 school districts where the lesser funded school district is receiving at least 10% less, on average, about $2,000 less per kid. And they are significantly more dense in terms of the students of color that they're serving. And so when we think about averages, we need to not just think about averaging somewhere in upstate New York and New York City, right? But we need to think about the school districts that are bordering each other, because that's really where you see the competition for the workforce. And that's where borders come in. And that's one of the reasons why understanding that states fund based on districts rather than based on kids is critically important in understanding the difference between whether policy is fixed or not. So I'll expand on that New York example. So New York City educates a ton of kids, and they get all kinds of special line items in the state budget. They have all kinds of local money from which to draw on. And so we tend to see New York City used as an example of a low-income school district that's getting $39,000. I mean, what else could you ask for, right? So we point out New York City and we say, you know, look, they should be doing better. $39,000 is a whole lot of money, but they're moving the goalpost compared to other districts that are serving students around the same poverty rate. So the 38, 39 districts that are serving this exact same poverty rate, as New York City are actually getting $27,000 per kid. So New York City is getting 39, the other districts are getting 27. So these other districts that may be smaller are getting 44% less money than New York City is. Do we just not care about those kids because they live in a smaller community and therefore can't average out against this large, highly funded school district? I would argue, no, we shouldn't not care about those kids. We absolutely should.
Right. That's like, say, a Yonkers, maybe. I should know my New York geography better. But
exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And again, I mean, to my ears, it still sounds like a whole lot of money. But the point is, in a competitive labor market, which, say, the New York metropolitan area is a competitive labor market for teachers, Yonkers is going to have a hard time if they're competing against, say, New York City on the one hand and maybe affluent suburban districts on the other. They're kind of stuck in the middle. David, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible for
things to be true on average and still disguise problems. So I'll co-sign on that. You know, we can imagine for schools, we probably don't have to imagine if we have a finance expert here with us, but, you know, we can imagine poor schools and rich schools being equally funded or close to it. And yet the, you know, still exhibiting a lot of variation within those categories that we should just consider inefficient and stupid, right? I mean, it could be the case that some poor districts get a lot more than others. And that's just bad, right? Like we don't want to distribute dollars randomly, even within subgroups, right? The efficient thing to do is to try to get the right amount of money to, you know, to, I say the right amount, like it's, you know, like it's written in the sky and it really isn't, but to try to spend money efficiently. And to the extent that we're just tossing chunks of money in random directions, which is kind of my summary of my understanding of how these formulas work, right? It's pretty likely to me that there is at a minimum some inefficiency in there, and probably some inequity as well.
I think that's right. And, you know, one of the things, and this is, you're kind of playing into my whole, you know, paradoxical statement, which is things may end up being equal, even if the funding formula has a bunch of garbage in it, right? If you were to look at a scatter plot of districts in almost all states, I call it a scatter plot, where basically you've got a whole bunch of dots that make absolutely no sense. If you had a school funding formula that was actually distributing dollars in a progressive way, you would see a clear slope in terms of how funding is being allocated, but you don't see that when you look on a district to district basis. So I'll give you an example, because everyone loves to quote Julian LaFortune's school funding reform paper that kind of hit with a big bang, that said, following school funding reforms, we saw the lowest quintile school districts receiving significantly more money. So school finance reforms worked. In fact, I think that this was one of the key points that that you had in your paper. One thing that you find in the appendices, if you really dig in, is that even though the lowest quintile school districts received more money, on average, free and reduced price students did not. The reason for that is because there are just as many free and reduced price lunch students living in the highest quintiles of income compared to the lowest quintile of income where all of the reforms were focused. And so that speaks to kind of an evening of where students live throughout our country. So it's a great thing that most of our school districts and communities are becoming more integrated on a socioeconomic basis. But that also means that we could be averaging out a whole bunch of variation in terms of how school districts are being funded.
Interesting. Yeah, that is fascinating. And I think you're referring, for example, to the inner ring suburbs that have become much more socioeconomically and racially diverse. Of course, Ben Harrell has a big book out about this right now. So what? Maybe we've won the last war about getting better and fairer financing into the big cities. And then a bunch of the poor kids have gotten pushed out of the big cities, and now they're in the inner ring suburbs, and we gotta fight that fight yet again. All right. Well, Rebecca, thank you. I learned a lot right there in that short amount of time, and look forward to learning much more as Ed Fund rolls out and starts doing its research and its work. I do hope you dig in maybe on some of these big metropolitan areas, because it does seem like, again, if you connect it to the teacher labor force, which is such an important factor, maybe that's the way to really think about these things and figure out how we're doing on the equity front.
Let me tell you one more thing. There is an important piece that we want to focus on at Ed Fund, which is tax policy. And so in Ohio, there are two neighbors where the lower income neighbor is raising property taxes that are 72% higher than their very wealthy neighbor. And that's because the majority of school districts or the majority of states in the US don't cap how much local communities can raise. And so in many states, we believe that the lower income communities may be overtaxing themselves in order to get to equity, but we don't have enough data to actually be able to study that. That's one of the things that Ed Fund is trying to push toward.
All right. Thanks again, Rebecca Sibilia, the founder of Ed Fund. Look forward to having you back on the show sometime soon.
Thank you so much. It was good to see you guys.
Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute.
Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, first up, I need to ask you your take on the Oscars.
Oh, man. You know what? I just feel for, gosh, what's his name? Who was in Maestro? Bradley Cooper. Bradley Cooper. Come on, Mike. He should have won that thing.
Really? Was he that good?
He was so good. I mean, I love Robert Downey Jr. Don't get me wrong. But Bradley Cooper, hands down, should have won it for Maestro.
I think it was Killian that won. That would have been for lead.
That's right. Well, anyway, Killian, I'm just saying, I'm on Bradley Cooper bandwagon.
Yeah. Look, I'm just glad that I know the name is pronounced Killian now instead of Cillian. I feel like, that much smarter. So yes. There you go. Hey, I will say I was surprised with the Emma Stone win, but that movie, Poor Things, it is a wacky, crazy, but amazing movie.
I have not seen it. Okay. Yes,
there you go. It's, you basically watch this woman. She has a baby's brain implanted into her head. And so you see a grown woman going through the stages of child development.
Oh, my. Yowza. That is an interesting screenplay. Yes. Yeah.
It's like that other movie that, what was the one, the short story, and then it was a movie and the guy is aging backwards?
Oh, the guy. Hello, Brad Pitt.
Oh, yes. There you go. Benjamin Button. Yeah.
Benjamin Buttons. Yes. Yes. That was.
Those two together.
That was. Women don't forget Brad Pitt movies. Sorry, Mike. No.
All right. Well, okay. Fine. All right. Well, that is fun. And now we have to turn to a topic that I understand is not so fun on the Research Minute this week.
That's right. It's a somber study. But as I was saying to you guys before, when these things happen, we say we're never going to forget. So that also means that we need to study the impact of them as well as not forgetting. So it examines the impact of students on student survivors of school shootings, specifically attendance, test scores, and long-term health outcomes. The analysts focus on the shootings at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut, and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. So those are the three biggies, I think, that most people remember on the news. But regardless, about 180,000 students have apparently been exposed to a school shooting during school hours since 1999. But again, those three I mentioned suffered the most fatalities and are more etched again into the consciousness of Americans. Specifically, Columbine experienced 15 deaths in 1999, Sandy Hook, 27 deaths in 2020. And Marjorie Stoneman Douglas was 17 deaths in 2018. Because these schools experience higher fatality shootings and were indiscriminate versus targeted shootings, the effects on survivors are hypothesized to be even more severe over and above shootings that are more targeted and have fewer fatalities. So the core analysis is a difference in differences methodology where patterns for students in affected schools are compared to outcomes for students attending non-affected schools in the same district before and after the shooting with school fixed effects and year fixed effects, and in some cases grade level fixed effects as well. In essence, they're treating the timing and location of these events as random, which enables likely causal effects. That said, they have school level, not student level data, which is important from CEDA. They also have state administrative data and mortality data from the Bureau of Vital Statistics. There's a long section about, how they're addressing potential mobility issues, where you can imagine higher performing kids may have subsequently left the school and district. And they also explain that, these impacts of shootings can be widespread. So there could be spillover effects, not only in the district, but in the state and even nationally, because again, we know how these things sort of embed in our consciousness. And in some places, they don't have multiple years of pre-trend data. So only, and also in Columbine, that was the only place where it was long enough ago to be able to examine the long-term impacts on the kids as older adults. So I don't have time. They go into the methodology for each one of these studies per school, but I just don't have time to do that. But The main idea is that it's a difference in difference methodology. All right, results. Not surprisingly, but sadly, very much so, results find that survivors of school shootings suffer negative consequences in both the immediate and subsequent years, as measured by test scores and attendance. For instance, in Parkland, the shooting led to significant declines in average test scores in the next year, as you can imagine, in two tested subjects, U.S. history and geometry, roughly 0.37 and 0.51 of a standard deviation, respectively, in the school level average on those exams. In Sandy Hook, they have longer trend data. So they find that students in the short term were more negatively impacted by the shooting versus the smaller negative effects in the longer term as students aged out of elementary school. And then even more tragically, they do a triple differences analysis, which controls for age and district and time fixed effects and a bunch of other stuff. And they find that Columbine survivors are more likely to die by age 30, especially the boys, as they face a greater likelihood of suicide or drug overdose. That is tough stuff. Specifically, they find that 7.8 additional suicides and 7.5 additional accidental overdoses occurred among male Columbine survivors than would have been expected through age 29. So that suggests that roughly as many survivors of the shooting died in the years that followed as died in the shooting itself. Based on studies involving fewer fatalities, these outcomes are comparatively worse. And then the analysts end, of course, with the questions we all have, which, you know, how do we prevent these shootings? I'm not going to get into a large political debate about guns, but I will suffice it to say that their lit review confirms that there's very little empirical evidence about the impact of what schools should be doing to prevent the sort of tragedy, including things like monitoring social media for dangerous student behaviors, installing metal detectors, adding security staff, and mental health services. But that doesn't obviously mean that we shouldn't be doing that stuff. So that's what I've got for today.
Oh, man. Yeah. That is just devastating. Yes. As many died after the event in Columbine as during it. Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just can't even imagine, you know, what those kids saw, you know?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm so torn on this, Amber. You know, it's important to know this, right? And yeah, it's partly we respect the survivors, you know, to remember that they're not okay after this, right? And that's important. I guess that's an important takeaway, that these kids are going to continue to need mental health supports.
That's right.
And yet, you know, we don't know what to do to stop these tragedies from happening, right? I mean, your list of big shootings, of course, didn't involve Uvalde because it's too recent. You know,
that's right. That's right.
These things keep happening. I don't know, David. How do you make sense of this?
Yeah, unfortunately, the study design is credible, Mike, which is another way of saying that it's plausibly random. I think you actually, thank you for finding something to take away from this. I think my biggest takeaway is what you just said, which is, even if we can't stop these things, or we struggle to know where to start, we have a responsibility, obviously, to track people and stay with them. And I assume that much of that is happening, but I probably shouldn't assume, right? Lots of people fall through the cracks in our society, even under normal circumstances. And it's, you know, if they fall through the cracks outside of these circumstances, it makes sense that they would also fall through the cracks under these circumstances. So it wouldn't shock me if many of these kids didn't get the follow-up support that ideally they would get. And I'm way outside my comfort zone here, you know, in terms of expertise, but I assume that this is not a question of weeks or months, but potentially years of follow-up and working with kids, adults probably at some point, you know, to try to help them. And so that's my biggest takeaway as well.
Yeah. I mean, we know now that veterans coming back from war, you know, we don't expect them to just be okay. right? And, you know, some of them, some of those off veterans had to deal with terrible scenes, you know, okay, you know, on a daily basis, repeatedly. But some people come back from war and they've, you know, maybe one bad incident that they have to deal with. And so it's not unlike what those kids at Columbine and these other schools experienced, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think you guys are hitting exactly on it, which is, you know, we don't want these type of policies in place, but these things tend to be, unfortunately, you know, keep happening. And so, yeah, I mean, to the extent that there should be some policy at the state level for survivors of these things, that's something that states should be putting in place.
Okay. Well, tough one, Amber, but thank you for bringing it to us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nonetheless, that is, though, all the time we've got for this week. And so until next week.
I'm David Griffin.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.